Well, good afternoon, and first of all, I'd like to say thank you to the congregation for hosting this series of studies, and I appreciate the opportunity from the congregation and Glenn to be entrusted with this topic and to have the opportunity to present this study for you all this afternoon. And of course, I have found this study to be very interesting and helpful to me, and so I hope that it will be the same for everyone here. The question that is posed on our study in the title is, did Jesus approve of David's sin? And the event that we are talking about, and we'll read the passage here in just a moment, is found in Matthew chapter 12, verses 1 through 7. As Glenn said, I added a title of my own, The Sabbath Showdown, and the reason for that is, while the main question that probably pops up in our minds as we read through Matthew 12, verses 1 through 7, is the specific example that Jesus uses concerning David, that's where most question comes in about that passage. To fully understand what Jesus is teaching about David, and thus whether David sinned and whether Jesus approved of that sin or not, we really need to understand the full context of what's taking place. We need to understand the full argument. And what we find there is Jesus is alluding to an example, but addressing a much bigger cause or a much bigger problem. And that was going to be one of the defining problems that he and the Pharisees were going to battle throughout his ministry. And that was a battle over the Sabbath and the interpretation of the Sabbath and what the Sabbath meant. And I hope that we can see that throughout our study. So there is much at play in Matthew chapter 12, verses 1 through 7, where we find kind of the highlight of what we want to talk about today. But we definitely want to understand the full portion of the passage as well. So very quickly, if you'd like to read along, just to go ahead and read this passage in its entirety. Matthew chapter 12, beginning verse 1, it says, at that time, Jesus went through the grain fields on the Sabbath, and his disciples were hungry and began to pluck heads of grain and to eat. And when the Pharisees saw it, they said to him, look, your disciples are doing what is not lawful to do on the Sabbath. But he said to them, have you not read what David did when he was hungry, he and those who were with him, how he entered the house of God and ate the showbread, which was not lawful for him to eat, nor for those who were with him, but only for the priests? Or have you not read in the law that on the Sabbath the priests in the temple profane the Sabbath and are blameless? Yet I say to you that one in this place, or that in this place there is one greater than the temple. But if you had known what this means, I desire mercy and not sacrifice, you would not have condemned the guiltless. So that's the passage that we have for our consideration this afternoon. And again, my goal is to look at the passage in its entirety to truly understand the points that are being made. A couple of questions that I want to address or hope to address that we all have an understanding of by the end of this study is, one, did Jesus approve of David's sin? I hope that we have an answer of that. But secondly, there's a qualifying question to that. What was David's sin? Also, what was the Pharisees' error? That's going to be key and instrumental in understanding what Jesus' teaching is what the error of the Pharisees on this occasion was. Also, this is a very important question. Did Jesus endorse situational ethics with this passage? Five, are there ever exceptions to God's law? That's a very important question that we're going to need to address, and that is addressed within this passage and the correlating passages. Also, there is a verse that we read there that was an allusion or a quotation from Hosea 6, verse 6. Jesus quoted the prophet Hosea saying, I desire mercy and not sacrifice. I think that we need to define that and ask ourselves, does God desire mercy in the place of sacrifice? And seventh and last, and I feel perhaps most importantly, what lessons from Matthew chapter 12 affect us today? Or what are the applications that we can truly learn from this passage and put into practice today? So those are really the main highlights of the questions that I want to answer and that I hope I can shed some light on in some way. Now, as I said, to understand this passage, we have to understand the context. And that's, of course, true of any passage within Scripture. We can't just rip passages out of their context. We have to treat them appropriately. And understanding the background to this passage is very, very important. Now, one thing that I find interesting is any time that a passage is referenced in all of the gospel accounts, or at least all of the synoptic gospel accounts. Again, any passage is important, but when the Holy Spirit sees fit to put a story in all of the synoptic gospels, being Matthew, Mark, and Luke, I think that there is definitely a cause for us to pay close attention to that passage. And that's the case with the events that are unfolded in Matthew chapter 12. These are recorded in Matthew, Mark, and in Luke. Now, Mark and Luke each have a couple of unique details, but Matthew's account is the lengthiest account. Matthew includes an extra argument, an extra example. All three allude to the argument from David, but Matthew uses an argument also about the priests. And also Matthew's account is the only one that goes back or records that Jesus issued the rebuke concerning understanding, Hosea 6, verse 6. And so this is a very important event. And it's not something for us to gloss over lightly. But also, the actual background. What were the events leading up to what happened on this particular Sabbath day? Well, I think there, when we look at that, we find some interesting events. Now, first of all, we find in Matthew chapter 9, an event that's recorded also by Mark and Luke, where Jesus healed a paralytic man. Now, this was a controversial event. Not because of the healing, but because before Jesus healed the paralytic man, he said, "Your sins are forgiven you." Well, the scribes took issue with that, because only God had the power to forgive sins. But to show that he was from God, Jesus said, "Which is easier, to say your sins are forgiven or rise up and walk?" And so that they would know he was the Son of God, he said, "Rise up and walk." But this was not something that sat well with the leaders. They had obviously been challenged by Jesus. And so we see some conflict and confrontation beginning between Jesus and the religious elite. Next, we find that Jesus called a disciple. This would be Matthew or Levi. And when he called him, Matthew was a tax collector. And the Jews hated the tax collectors. Well, when Matthew became a disciple, he threw a feast that is recorded in Matthew, Mark, and Luke for the Lord. And the Lord went to this event at Matthew's house. And there were other tax collectors, other people that the Pharisees saw, sinners. And they took issue with this. And they said, "Why do you eat with tax collectors and sinners?" Well, all of the gospel writers, all Matthew, Mark, and Luke, write that Jesus told them, the physician doesn't need to come to heal the well, but the sick. But Matthew also includes an exhortation that the other two writers do not. And he said, "Go and learn what this means. I desire mercy and not sacrifice." The exact same verse that he references in our passage in Matthew chapter 12. But he encouraged them to go and learn what was meant by Hosea's statement, "I desire mercy and not sacrifice." But again, we see some confrontation here. And then the last event that took place before this passage is the healing, a healing on the Sabbath. Jesus healed a man on the Sabbath. John 5 records this event. This is the man at the pool of Bethesda. Jesus told him to take up your bed and walk. And of course, some Jews took issue with him walking with his bed because it was the Sabbath day. Now, in John 5, we don't see any confrontation between the Pharisees and Jesus, but we see that they are angry at Jesus because of what he had done and what he had told this man to do on the Sabbath. And that's going to be kind of the foundation for what would become a great Sabbath controversy between the religious elite and Jesus. Also, right after that, and during that passage, we're told that the Jews started to begin to seek to kill him, because not only did Jesus, in their mind, profane the Sabbath, but he called God his Father, making himself equal with God. So the foundation has been set, the scene has been set for there to be great controversy between Jesus and the religious elite. And I don't want to spend much time on this, but the events that follow this passage are also interesting, because after the healing in John 5, after the events of Matthew 12, there are going to be at least four additional healings that Jesus does on the Sabbath, all of which brought about some controversy with the Pharisee. He healed the man with the withered hand, the account right after Matthew chapter 12 that we're looking at. We see him healing a man born blind in John chapter 9. We see him healing a crippled woman in Luke chapter 13. And also Jesus healing a man with dropsy in Luke chapter 14. And all of these events, all of these wonderful, merciful miracles of Jesus were challenged by the Pharisees. They were angry at all of these for Jesus healing on the Sabbath, feeling that he had broken the Sabbath law. Now, on most of these occasions, at least three of these four occasions, Jesus was going to rebuke the Pharisees' hypocrisy concerning their regulation of the Sabbath. After all, they would pull an ox out of the ditch on the Sabbath, but they didn't want him to heal a crippled woman. They would lead an ox to the watering trough on the Sabbath and be okay with that, but they didn't want Jesus to heal someone who had had a disease for 18 years. And so he would point out their hypocrisy on subsequent events. But I think one thing that's key to understanding Matthew 12, verse 1 through 7, is Jesus is not addressing the hypocrisy of the Pharisees in this passage. He was going to do that in subsequent events. But in Matthew chapter 12, what I think he is doing is addressing the core foundational problem that led to the hypocrisy of the Pharisees. Their understanding and application of the Sabbath law was what was the problem. And that's what Jesus addresses in Matthew chapter 12, verses 1 through 7. So, as we look at the background, it says that at the time Jesus went through the grain fields on the Sabbath, his disciples were hungry and began to pluck heads of grain and to eat. Now, this was a common practice, and we don't need to spend a lot of time on this, but Deuteronomy 23, this was perfectly acceptable. Within God's law, there was provision for needy and hungry people that were traveling, and farmers, people with grain fields, weren't supposed to be so greedy that they wouldn't let anyone have that grain. But if you were traveling through a field and you were hungry, you were allowed to pull from the grain and eat it. Or in a vineyard, you could pull some of the grapes and eat it. Now, you didn't go out with your sickle and begin harvesting that individual's grain. That was stealing. But to just travel through the field and to take of it for your need, that was perfectly acceptable. And that is what the disciples are doing. So it's not stealing that's the issue with the Pharisees here, but it's the fact that it was their interpretation of the Sabbath and what the disciples were doing. Matthew 2, or the second verse, says, "When the Pharisees saw it, they said to him, 'Look, your disciples are doing what is not lawful to do on the Sabbath.'" Now, Luke sheds a little bit of additional light on this. In his passage, Luke 6, verse 1, it says, "It happened on the second Sabbath after the first that he went through the grain fields, and his disciples plucked the heads of grain and ate them, rubbing them in their hands." Now, that's important because that was part of what the Pharisees took issue with. They were not upset with the disciples for stealing. They understood the privilege issued by the law, by Deuteronomy, but they felt that what the disciples were doing was a violation of the Sabbath law. They saw picking heads of grain, and particularly rubbing those heads of grain in one's hand and discarding of the husk that was left over, as a form of work, and thus a violation of the Sabbath. Now, there's a few things that seem immediately apparent about the disciples' actions. First of all, the disciples did not seem to think that what they were doing was wrong. That does not justify them. But they obviously had no issue with this. They also did not seem to think that Jesus would disapprove of their actions. It's hard to believe that they would have been doing this had they thought Jesus took issue with it. But thirdly, it doesn't seem that Jesus had issue with this. Never do we find Jesus excusing sinful behavior of his disciples. In fact, when we see that they err, Jesus is the first to rebuke them. And yet he does not rebuke them in this instance. So it seems Jesus did not have issue with what the disciples were doing. But the Pharisees see this as a violation, and due to that violation, they present Jesus with the question of why he is allowing this to take place. Now, to respond to the Pharisees' accusation that the disciples are breaking the Sabbath, Jesus is going to respond not with just an answer. And we see this so commonly. Jesus didn't just say, "Well, they're just breaking your traditions, not God's law." He could have done that. And he would have been completely right in doing that. But that's not what Jesus did. Instead, he goes through a much longer answer to show the core problem of what their issue was. He's going to use two examples, an example from the life of David and an example from the priests, to show the error of their application. He's going to issue a rebuke in verse 7 of their misunderstanding. And this isn't really part of our passage. It's an important part of this passage, but we really won't have time to deal with it today. But in verse 8, I feel that Jesus is issuing the final verdict of the accusation as the Son of Man and the one who has authority to know when people have broken the Sabbath and when they have not. Now, as we look at this issue, and specifically as we get into what was Jesus saying about David and thus his disciples, there are one of three possibilities that take place. First of all, David and the disciples both sinned. If that's the case, if David sinned and the disciples sinned, but Jesus goes through this explanation, then what Jesus is doing is excusing both of their sins based upon their situations. They sinned, but it was okay because of their situation. The other possibility is that David sinned, but the disciples did not sin. And if that's the case, then Jesus' argument is more about their hypocrisy. It's more about, well, you know, David did something wrong, and you don't find fault with him. My disciples have not done something wrong, and you find fault with them. That's hypocritical. Now, the other option that we have is that neither David or the disciples sinned. And the what that would mean is when Jesus is rebuking the Pharisees, he's not rebuking their hypocrisy again on this occasion, but their misinterpretation and their misapplication of the law, specifically the law regarding the Sabbath. Now, my opinion just up front is the latter of these three options is what's taking place here. And I think that, and I've come to that conclusion based on the whole passage, when you look at all of the arguments, when you look at the additional argument Jesus makes about the priests, when you look at his reference to Hosea 6 verse 6, what we find is Jesus is exposing their misinterpretation and their misapplication of the law, which was a very serious thing. Now, to understand this and to look at this, we don't want to do a study on the Sabbath. That's not our goal here today. But we need to understand the Sabbath law, and we need to understand the error of the Pharisees in interpreting the Sabbath law. So when we go back and we look at the Sabbath, the very first time we find it is in the creation account. God created the world in 6 days, and on the seventh day, he rested. The day after he made man, God rested. And we're told that he sanctified that day because in it he rested from all his work which God had created and made. We find the next sections that cover the law of the Sabbath come in the book of Exodus. During the wilderness wanderings, we find in Exodus 16 the next mention of the Sabbath. This was before God gave the Ten Commandments. This is before the law was given at Mount Sinai. God gave law concerning the collection of manna. They were to collect manna on 6 days, and on the sixth day they were to take in a double portion so they wouldn't go out and collect manna on the seventh day, because the seventh day, the Sabbath, was a day of rest. We see it given and expounded upon in Exodus 20, verse 8 and 11, also in Deuteronomy, in the giving of the Ten Commandments. That was the fourth commandment, was to observe the Sabbath and keep it holy. We see it expounded upon by God to Moses, both on Mount Sinai and at the door of the tabernacle in Exodus and Leviticus. And then we find Moses expounding upon the law as he's giving the law to the people in Exodus 35, verse 1 through 3. If we were to go and study all of these passages together, we can kind of neatly tie up the Sabbath as the following. First of all, it is a holy day. It's not a common day. It's not a day that doesn't mean anything. It is a holy, sanctified day. Secondly, it was a day of rest. It was a day in which the people were not to do any work. And the law was very clear about that. You shall not do work on the Sabbath. Shall not kindle a fire on the Sabbath. In Numbers, there's an example of a man who was caught gathering sticks on the Sabbath, and he was put to death. And the law required that someone that profaned the Sabbath through work be put to death. So we see that while it was a day of rest, it wasn't just a day of laziness. It was a day to be taken very seriously as a day of rest and as a holy day. This was a day designed to draw the people closer to God, to refocus them on God, if you will. But we also see that the Sabbath was a blessing given by God. This was not a burden on the people. This was not designed by God to be a burden on the people. It was a day of blessing. And that's one thing we all need to always remember about God's law, is God's laws are blessings. Many people don't look at God's law that way. They look at God's law as burdens. But they are blessings. And the Sabbath day was a blessed day. It was a day of blessing. It was a day that helped them, that strengthened them. Or at least it was supposed to. But it was a day of blessing. And Jesus even alludes to this in Mark's account. Mark records one other argument of Jesus, that he said to them, the Sabbath was made for man and not man for the Sabbath. The Sabbath was a law that God had put into his law for the people for their benefit and for their blessing. That's important, because what did the Pharisees do to the Sabbath? The Pharisees made the law an incredible burden, especially the law of the Sabbath. Now, there's many commentators that have talked about this, many places we can go, but the Pharisees had decided, and they did this with many laws, to put this big fence around God's law to make sure and clarify for the people what it meant to honor the Sabbath. Now, the truth is, God's law concerning the Sabbath was clear. It was very easily understood. And if one kept it appropriately, it was a day of blessing and rest, an opportunity to set aside the toil of daily physical life to be refreshed, and particularly refreshed by setting aside the physical to focus on the spiritual. The Pharisees, however, as they had done with so many laws, had put their own regulations, their own guidelines, their own clarifications around the Sabbath, and worse still, they considered their traditions and regulations as binding as God's law itself. Just a couple of examples of what they had done. The Pharisees, or the rabbis, over time said, you know, you couldn't take a bath on the Sabbath. Because what if some water spills out of the bathtub and you have to mop it up? Well, mopping it up's work, so you shouldn't take a bath on the Sabbath. You can't spit on the Sabbath. Jesus challenged this, by the way, in one of his healings when he spit and made eye salve. But you can't spit on the Sabbath. Why? Because what if someone steps on it? And then they wipe it off their foot. Well, they've begun to till the ground in that situation. Ludicrous, but that was one of their laws. You couldn't drag a chair because what if by dragging a chair, the leg of the chair put a furrow in the ground, and now you've begun the process of harvesting and you're working. You're profaning the Sabbath. On and on and on. They had thousands of these regulations about the Sabbath. What had the Pharisees done? They had taken the very simple law that God had given, and they had made it something that was almost impossible to keep. They took something that was a day of rest and a blessing, and they turned it into an incredible burden that hardly anyone could possibly keep. They had completely lost sight of the focus of the Sabbath with their man-made regulation and traditions. And this is exactly what they've done concerning the disciples. Some of the additional thoughts they had was if you were to pick a grain of head or a grain of wheat, I'm saying that completely, a head of wheat, then you have begun harvesting, you're reaping. If you take that wheat and you rub it in your hands to get rid of the husk, well, that's the same thing as threshing. And then with the husk, you blow it out of your hand or you discard it on the side of the road, well, that's winnowing. So by simply plucking a head of wheat and rubbing it in your hands and eating it and discarding the chaff left over, you have worked and you have profaned the Sabbath. That's ridiculous. No one in their right mind would look at someone that picked a head of wheat and ate it as working. But according to the Pharisaic interpretation of the law, that's exactly what was taking place. And that's what they take issue with the disciples here, because they are picking grain and rubbing it in their hands and discarding it. Thus, they are profaning the holy day of the Sabbath. So, this is important for us to see these things, because it's this misunderstanding, it's this misapplication of the law that leads to Jesus' teaching. When we understand the problem, we can understand the teaching. And so here, in future events, Jesus is going to rebuke the hypocrisy that was brought about by this interpretation. But in this instance, in this first showdown, if you will, about the Sabbath, Jesus cuts to the core foundational problem. And that was the misinterpretation and the misapplication of the law. The Pharisees had misapplied the law, and in an attempt to clarify what God had already said with their own think-sos and their own ideas, they made the law mean something it had never meant. And the end result of that was they condemned individuals that the law of God did not condemn. Thus, Jesus exposed their misinterpretation and rebuked their ignorance, as we find in Matthew's account. So the first lesson Jesus uses to do this is a lesson from the life of David. It says in verse 3 through 4, "But he said to them, 'Have you not read what David did when he was hungry, he and those who were with him, how he entered the house of God and ate the showbread which was not lawful for him to eat, nor for those who were with him, but only for the priests?'" So to show the Pharisees the effects of their over-rigid, ritualistic approach to the law, Jesus used two Old Testament examples to show the inconsistency and the impracticability of their application. The first example involved a story from the life of David and how he was given showbread by the priest for food. Now, before we read this story, it helps us to know about the showbread. Again, like the Sabbath, this is not the main focus of our story. But Leviticus 24, verse 5 through 9, you find the law concerning the showbread. Basically, the priests were commanded upon the Sabbath day. This is ironic, and this is going to tie right into Jesus' point about the Sabbath and the priests. But the priests on the Sabbath were to bake 12 loaves of bread, and they were to place them on the table of showbread. And there were laws about how that table was to be constructed. This was in the tabernacle and later the temple. They were to place these 12 loaves of bread on the table. They were to be there perpetually, always, constantly. And every Sabbath, they baked 12 new loaves and replaced the old loaves. And the law said that the loaves that were taken away, the loaves that were no longer on the table, were to be eaten by the priests. That's what the law states. They are to be eaten by the priests. Now we find within the showbread and also within much of the Levitical law that much of the sustenance for the priests came from the sacrificial offerings. In more than one occasion, the sacrifices that were a very spiritual thing were, after they were offered as a sacrifice to be eaten, they were to be physically consumed for the sustenance of the priests. We find it in Exodus 29. We find it in Leviticus 6 through 7, laws concerning the consumption, and different sacrifices had different laws. Some of them had specific spiritual meaning attached to the priest eating the law or eating of the sacrifice. Others don't really give any further explanation other than they were to be eaten by the priests and the priest's sons. So we see that they were provided for by the sacrifices, the sin offering, the burnt offering, the peace offering, the grain offering. All of these had rules around who could eat them. Sometimes it was just the priest making the sacrifice. Sometimes it was the priest's family. In Leviticus 10, verses 12 through 14, we find this as well, and we see there that it was really that sometimes the food that was eaten by the priest was actually considered their due. You hate to say it this way, but it's almost their payment. This is part of their livelihood. And even in some occasions, like Leviticus chapter 10 shows us, it was to be eaten by the priests, the priest's sons, and even the priest's daughters. Now, the priest's daughters were not priests. They didn't offer sacrifices. But their physical needs, their physical hunger was also met by the food that was used in sacrificial worship. So we see something that is important and that is always present within God's law that we should never overlook. But even though there were things that were part of the ceremonial law of God, within that law, God provided a provision for the physical needs, the common needs, if you will, of his people, particularly of the priests, when it comes to many of these sacrifices. So that lets us know about the showbread. It was to be placed upon the table every Sabbath. The old bread was taken off and it was used as food to feed the priests. Well, we come to 1 Samuel 21, the setting for Jesus' argument. Again, I don't want to spend our time reading, but just a quick paraphrase. This is David. He's on the run from King Saul. Saul has become jealous. Saul's decided he wants to kill David. David takes off when he knows he can't possibly stay around Saul any longer. And as he's running, some of his men have chosen to continue with him, to follow him. They've been on the run. Obviously, they're hungry. They're in need. They can't just go get food the way they used to. They are outlaws. They are fugitives. But David approaches the tabernacle, which is apparently at this time in Nob, and comes to Ahimelech the priest and asks him for food. He didn't ask him for the showbread. He asked him for food, any food that they have. But there's a problem. The only food that the priest has is the showbread. Now, apparently, he had already placed new showbread on the table. They had not eaten the old showbread yet, but that's all that they have. And we see Ahimelech has a little bit of concern about just handing this bread over willy-nilly, if you will, to David. He questions him a little bit about his men. But we also see in 1 Samuel 22, verse 10, it appears that Ahimelech had inquired of God at some point during this exchange, before giving David the bread, before giving David the sword of Goliath and sending him on his way. So Ahimelech didn't just take this lightly. But at the end, Ahimelech decides to take care of David and to provide for David and his men's need. He decided it was okay to give David the bread, which was for his own food and consumption. Now again, the law states the priests are to eat that food. And so what's Jesus' point? What is Jesus saying about this story where David ate the showbread? David wasn't a priest, so David shouldn't have had the showbread. Is Jesus saying that David and Ahimelech did something sinful, but it was okay because of the situation? Not at all. I don't think that's what Jesus is saying in any way. Jesus was not advocating situational ethics in this case. And I think it's pretty clear because we need to remember what situational ethics are. People who endorse situational ethics are really trying to redefine morality. What that teaches us is that there is no absolute moral standard. But instead, morality, thus right and wrong, is to be determined based upon one's needs. Situation ethics teaches us that something that is typically wrong, morally wrong, such as lying or stealing, maybe even murder, can be okay if the right conditions are met. There might be times it's okay to lie. There might be times it's okay to steal. But that's not what Jesus is saying. And if Jesus wanted to advocate that, he had a perfect opportunity to do so right here. Because David had lied. If you want the quick answer to our study, did Jesus approve of David's sin? No, he did not. He didn't say anything about David's sin. I wholeheartedly believe that David lied to Ahimelech. When Ahimelech asked him why he was there, he told him he was on a mission from Saul. He wasn't on a mission from Saul. David lied. But Jesus didn't even address that. Jesus, if he wanted to endorse situational ethics, could have made the argument that David was justified in lying because of his situation. But he doesn't. And we shouldn't take Jesus looking over that part of the story as accepting it. On the contrary, I think it shows Jesus did not accept David's lie as okay. Jesus instead focuses upon the eating of the showbread. Now, some say the main point in the confusion here is even Jesus says in Matthew 12, verse 4, that he took of the bread which was not lawful for him to eat, nor those who were with him. So was it lawful or not for Jesus, for David to take this bread? Is Jesus saying it wasn't lawful? Well, I think Matthew's account is tremendously important because the next argument helps clarify this. Because in the next argument about the priest, Jesus says, or have you not read how the priests profane the Sabbath? I don't think anyone would say that Jesus was actually arguing that the priest profaned the Sabbath. He wasn't condemning the priest. He didn't say that the priest profaned the Sabbath. What he is saying is by the rigid ritualistic interpretation of the Pharisaic law, or interpretation of the law, the priest profaned the Sabbath. Likewise, and then we'll get to that in a moment, but likewise, Jesus is not making an excuse for David's sin, but he is pointing out that the permitted action of David and Ahimelech could not be permitted by the Pharisaic mindset, although they seemingly did allow it. But really, if you took their philosophy to its fullest conclusion, they would have to condemn David and Ahimelech for allowing David to eat of the showbread. Now, it seems that it was okay with Ahimelech to give David the showbread. It seems that it was even okay with God, whom Ahimelech inquired of, to give David the showbread in order to help David and his men in their severe necessity. See, Ahimelech had grasped something long ago that the Pharisees had lost sight of. He was willing to forego his own sustenance, his own food that by right of law, God's law, was his, in order to show mercy and offer aid to one of God's children who was truly in need. Now, to do this did not require Ahimelech to compromise morals or ethics. Instead, it required him to see that in this instance, to care for David's need was more pressing than simply filling his belly on the premise that the law stated the showbread was to be eaten by the priests. When you think about it, Ahimelech and David were actually put in a very difficult situation because the law of the showbread was not the only law in effect right now. After all, Deuteronomy 15, verse 7 and 8 says, if there's among you a poor man of your brethren within any of the gates in your land which the Lord your God has given you, you shall not harden your heart, nor shut your hand from your poor brother, but you shall open your hand wide to him and willingly lend him sufficient for his need, whatever he needs. Essentially, Ahimelech had two laws that seemingly came into conflict. By the law, he was to care for his needy brother. I think David's situation is quite applicably stated as needy. He's on the run for his life. Now, he had lied about that, but he is in need. Ahimelech knows that David and his men are hungry. They've been without food for some time. He has a legal responsibility to God's law to take care of this. But he also has a legal responsibility to obey the law of the showbread. But he chose to adhere to the law of mercy over the law of the showbread in this situation. Again, Ahimelech seemed okay with it. David seemed okay with it. God, whom he acquired of, seemed okay with it. And I think Jesus is stating the same thing. Now, the Pharisees in their interpretation of the law could not have done this because of their rigid, ritualistic views. Now, we need to hasten on. And so we look at the second lesson, the lesson from the priest. Or have you not read in the law that on the Sabbath the priests of the temple profane the Sabbath and are blameless? Yet I say to you that in this place there is one greater than the temple. We don't have time to deal with verse 6 today, but verse 5, Jesus continues to show the error of their application. The Sabbath law, remember the Sabbath law. You shall do no work. Everyone who profanes it shall be put to death. You shall kindle no fire. But what did the priests do on the Sabbath? In Numbers 28, we find there were extra sacrifices that the priest had to do specifically on the Sabbath. Guess what's entailed with preparing a sacrifice? Work. Guess what else is entailed with preparing a sacrifice? Quite frequently, a kindling of a fire. We see they were to prepare the showbread on the Sabbath. So what was it that the Pharisees did on the Sabbath? The Pharisees worked. In fact, they probably worked harder on the Sabbath than they actually did on the other 6 days of the week. They went through the same routines and additional routines on the Sabbath. What you have here is two laws that seemingly conflict and honestly are irreconcilable by the Pharisaic mindset. The rigid interpretation of thou shalt not work cannot be reconciled with you should prepare sacrifices and kindle fire to do so on the Sabbath. So which law gives? Well, God had stated which law gives. God stated that the priest's duty was a commandment. The law concerning the worship and the service to God overshadowed or superseded a no-work mandate of the Sabbath. That was quite clear. It was quite understood. No one would condemn the priests. And yet, honestly, that's exactly what a Pharisee would have to do with their interpretation. And thus, Jesus rebukes them. Remember Matthew 9:13, he said, go learn what this means. They had failed. They had not learned what that meant. And so now he rebukes them. He says, but if you had known what this means, I desire mercy, not sacrifice, you would not have condemned the guiltless. So after exposing their error in interpretation and application, he issues this rebuke. They clearly had not come to understand what this meant. Now, this passage, this specific phrase, is something that has been taken out of context by far too many people. And we need to understand exactly what is being taught. Jesus is going back to the prophet Hosea. In Hosea 6, verse 6, we find this phrase, I desire mercy and not sacrifice. Now, to understand that, it helps us to understand the context of that chapter. We won't read this. I encourage you to do so. But essentially what takes place in Hosea 6 is God, by the mouth of Hosea, his prophet, issues his condemnation of the nation in verses 1 through 5. He condemns them. What I think verse 6 is a proactive rebuttal against what was likely the people's response. But we're offering sacrifices. We're obeying the ceremonial law. And thus, the prophet explains the people's evil to them in verses 7 through 11. They might have been offering sacrifices. They probably offered thousands of sacrifices. But they were evil people. They were violent. They were unmerciful. They were immoral. They were not holy people. And this was a problem that happened over and over again. The law of Leviticus is a very structured law. It's a very, you know, you can say rigid. There's a lot of laws about sacrifices, a lot of laws about feasts and holy days. But the law was not just meant to be a checklist. It was for a purpose. Leviticus 19 and 2 says, "Speak to all the congregation of the children of Israel and say to them, you shall be holy, for I, the Lord your God, am holy." What was the purpose of the sacrifices, of the Sabbaths, of the feasts, of all of the rules and regulations of the law? Was it just to keep the children of Israel incredibly busy? No. The purpose of the law was to draw the people of God closer to Him, to make them more like Him, to make them loving, to make them merciful, to make them moral, to make them upright, to make them holy. The problem was, far too often, they based their religion on their sacrifices. We see it in King Saul, offering sacrifice. Instead of destroying the Amalekites, they saved some of the animals for sacrifice. And Samuel said, "Oh, to obey is better than sacrifice." Isaiah dealt with this. I wish we had time to go and look at Isaiah. But there, God says, basically, that all of their Sabbath days, all their Sabbaths, all their convocations, all their sacrifices disgust God. Why? Well, why is God disgusted by what He commanded? Because it had no impact on the people, because they were still evil, because they were still violent. Micah 6, verse 6 through 8, pleads for the people to seek to do good, to be righteous people. What they had done is they had based their religion on the sacrifice. Well, the Pharisees suffered from a similar problem. They sought to be justified by their ritualistic practices. They even added rituals and fences around God's law to ensure people followed them correctly. What's interesting is the Pharisees swung the pendulum from using the ritualistic law as a license to sin. As long as we offer sacrifices, we'll do what we want. They swung it the other way, and they based their religion, they based their service to God off of really nothing more than ritual and practice. They lost sight of the purpose of the law. They didn't let the law make them holy. They didn't let the law make them merciful. On the contrary, their application of the law made them view holiness as a mere matter of practice. And thus, it made them subject the law of mercy to the law of ceremony. The exact opposite of what Ahimelech had done for David. They had gone the opposite direction of the law. And their interpretation and application, which lost sight of the purpose, brought them to a point where they actually began to condemn the innocent, where the law did not find these people guilty. That is exactly what the Pharisees had done to Jesus' disciples, and we can be assured that the disciples weren't the first, nor were they the last innocents that were condemned by the law. We've only got around 2 minutes left here, so I don't get to spend as much time on this as I would like to, but some applications that we need to realize very seriously today. First of all, we need to be very reverent and careful in the way in which we interpret and apply God's law. The Scriptures teach us that we are to rightly divide the word of truth. That implies there is a wrong way of dividing the word of truth. There are people that divide the word of truth too loosely. They explain away commandments. They explain away examples. They explain away what God tells us we need to do, and they loosen it too much. And that's wrong. But there are also people that are much like the Pharisees from time to time that add their own clarifications, their own rules, their own regulations to God's law. I think in an honest attempt to help people, but sometimes as time goes on, we've got our own traditions that we adhere to as much as we do the law of God. And that is wrong. God stated His law the way God wanted His law to be stated. And it is not our prerogative or right to clarify that for everyone and tell everyone what that means by adding our own think-sos. But also, we need to realize that God's law is a blessing. There's so many people today that call us legalistic, that don't want to be a part of the law. That means we've misinterpreted the law. The law is a blessing. It's there for our benefit. It's there to strengthen us. It's there to encourage us. It's there to keep us on track and protect us. God's law is a blessing. I also don't want us to take the wrong notion from this and say that God's ceremonial laws or the rituals that we have are unimportant. They're very important. Nadab and Abihu show us the ceremonial law was not to be trifled with. Uzzah shows us the ceremonial law was not to be trifled with. It is very important, and we do not have the right to break the ceremonial law. And what we need to realize is God-given exceptions, like David eating the showbread, are not breaking a ceremonial law. They are a God-given exception. We also need to take note, we don't just get to come up with exceptions. They are given by God. We find the priest's exception was given by God. Ahimelech inquired of God. There was another law that was in play. So we don't just go about seeking exceptions. We need to very reverently approach God's ceremonial law. But also, and lastly, we cannot let ritual define our Christianity. Ritual and ceremony are vastly important, but we can never let it define our religion. Being immersed, eating of one loaf, drinking of one cup, coming to worship every Lord's Day, singing without instruments, all of these are vital to proper worship and salvation. But if that is all that defines our Christianity, we're no better than the Pharisees. If we don't let the worship impact our lives to become holy people, the law has been lost upon us. Jesus extended what Leviticus 19 and 2 said in Matthew 5 verse 48. He said, "Therefore you shall be perfect just as your Father in heaven is perfect." And Peter even quoted Leviticus and said the same thing. If we don't let the law make us holy, godly people, it doesn't matter if we go to church every Sunday. It doesn't matter if we only use one loaf and one cup. It doesn't matter if we were immersed. If we aren't holy, transformed people, like Romans 12 and 2 says, we're just like the Pharisees of old.